Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is Now or Never. And we've got Paul Venable. And we just actually wrapped up with the Kentucky resolutions. Now, folks, there are literally five documents we're diving through. The Kentucky resolutions was the spark. It was the catalyst that started the actions of interposition. Now, the words interposition haven't come up at all yet. And what we want to do is we're going to actually show you how this all lays out, which is why last time, yesterday, what we did was we showed how Jefferson brings up nullification. Right, Paul? Right?
Yes, he does.
But he doesn't talk about nullifying. He says that the right of every state to nullify is clearly, you know, a privilege and a right held by every state. Mm-hmm. But he's not calling, nowhere in here does he say we must nullify. The state of Kentucky is nullifying this law.
Correct.
And as a matter of fact, what he does is he calls for all of the states to unite. That's what he's calling for. Now, he is saying that if you're so, you know, if you're as pissed off as we are, if you're more pissed off than we are, I should say, and you're, you know, wanting to go down this path of nullifying, then that's on you. But he doesn't talk about the consequences or the details or anything like that. And right. So this is why it became incumbent on Madison in his very final document, in the fifth document we're going to cover, why Madison actually goes into the details of the doctrine of nullification to help school those people at that point in time that didn't really understand in the 1800s this concept of nullification, because they actually had a government that was really behaving well. And so they, you know, many people were losing this historical context of nullification.
Okay.
So anyway, I'm kind of ready to go, but what I will do is I'll say this, because I just had a presentation last night in the Wyoming, and I'm going to get this county wrong because I'm really bad with names, but in the Wyoming Central Committee, they invited me to come speak regarding the convention or what to do about federal overreach. And so I literally fire hose them. And folks, I think anybody that has ever listened to this show, I know I go at, I'm not at a snail's pace. Let's just say that. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I even speak fragmented, but the beautiful thing about the presentation that I gave last night was I didn't just stick with slides and read and do that. It was really my first opportunity at providing an inside detailed look at, you know, the Convention of State folks. Now, I also provided an inside look on the nullifiers. I didn't go to their websites because there is no really website for nullifiers. There is the 10th Amendment Center, the John Birch Society, the advocates. These are different advocates. And as a matter of fact, as you just pointed out yesterday, Paul, that in a separate correspondence, of course, that the Heritage Foundation has come on to standing up for the Convention of States.
Right.
And I'm going, wow, this is so interesting how it is really becoming a binary issue. It's either this or that. There's nothing else that we can talk about. And so this presentation, folks, literally points out the fact that, you know, both sides are calling for people to either use leeches to suck the blood out of you or to cut your veins so that you can bleed out a little bit to cure the problem.
Right.
They're both providing perverted methodologies that will not fix the problem. And so what I have to do, and actually this is what I hope to do, I'm not sure if Angeline can give me the time, And I know she does listen to these shows. And I know those who want to, you know, those who are willing to learn and open up books, you know, because I challenge everybody. I challenged everybody last night. I challenge you folks to prove me wrong. The documentation is there. And as a matter of fact, I wasn't trying to be arrogant, but I have said and I do say that when it comes to me having a debate with a constitutional lawyer, 9 times out of 10, I drive them out of the room because they don't know the founding documents. They can't cite them. They can cite precedents and court cases and how the judges have interpreted the Constitution, but they can't tell me how the framers defined it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go back and say, hey, the judges don't have the authority to redefine the Constitution. When they say they're using interpretation and they're actually redefining something that was defined, this only supports the concept of republic review and definitizing the Constitution, setting up federal review committees in every state, getting the parents to actually sit down, get to the table, and get some work done in fixing and cleaning up this constitutional republic. It's their job to do. And so anyway, thank you for letting me rant, Paul. I appreciate that. So,
well, no problem. We've done this before.
Yeah, and I really do appreciate your patience with me because I'm not the guy that necessarily I'm not doing any of this to make myself feel better, and I'm definitely not doing this to make money. So, with that, and I know you know that, and so with that, let's dive into Madison's response. So the Kentucky resolution was written, I think, I guess I need to really pull it up. And I wasn't planning on pulling it up. You don't need to pull it up, Paul, but okay. I'm going to pull it up because Jefferson pinned the date of this, if I remember correctly, October 29th or something like that. In other words, it was at the very end of October, right? And so where was Jefferson in 1798? He was at Monticello. Now, Monticello is not too far from Kentucky, right? And what's the capital of Kentucky? Louisville, or I don't know.
I'm sorry, it's Frankfort.
Frankfort, okay. So I'm not sure how far it is horseback ride to ride a horse from Monticello to the capital, but it was in the 20s. It was the 26th, 27th, 29th, something like that. And I could go to the Avalon Project and look it up, but I'm not going to. What's really important is that it took time to get somebody on a horse to drive or ride that horse that many miles on trails. These weren't roads like we have today. And so you have to really kind of know where you're going. And so, you know, obviously this was a professional horse rider that probably took this, but it took days. It didn't happen just overnight.
So quick question.
Right.
Jefferson didn't live in Kentucky.
Ah, but right. Kentucky was a part of what state?
It was a part of Virginia.
There you go, my friend. See, now, why would he write the resolutions for Kentucky?
Well, I think that the reason he would do that, we've discussed this before, so it's not, I'm not coming up with this originally. He was addressing the issue of the Alien and Sedition Acts. John Adams is president.
No. Okay, Thomas Jefferson. Okay, so, right? But why did he send these to the state legislature of Kentucky? Ah. Now, you got to remember that the Alien and Sedition Acts were passed by Congress on the 14th day of July, that same year. So, Madison and Jefferson had a conversation, and I believe they were actually up. Well, no, that was in the early 90s, so never mind. So these guys had to have had a conversation as to how they were going to act, what they each of them were going to do. Right. And so Jefferson said, I will write a draft of resolutions and send them to the Kentucky State Legislature, because I have the credentials that will actually get these men to read this. He could walk. Okay. So Jefferson could have easily got on a horseback and actually went and rode all the way to Kentucky and walked in and would have commanded full respect and would have been able to basically hijack the state legislature.
Oh, that was just Jefferson's stature at the time.
Correct.
Okay.
You know, it's not that these men believed that they were gods or that the people treated them like gods. They had that respect. Mm-hmm. And so Jefferson penned these and sent them to his friends in Kentucky, mm-hmm. because Kentucky was a part of their state. They knew each other. As a matter of fact, his father basically surveyed the land of Kentucky.
Okay.
I mean, anybody that understands, you know, Jefferson and his upbringing, his father was constantly on the road surveying the western lands of Virginia for mm-hmm. the colony of Virginia. So they were pretty well known. And so when Jefferson really made a name for himself, he was a beloved man of the country of Virginia. And that's how they looked at that yeah. time in these early days of the Republic. Each state was a country. They considered right. themselves countrymen.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Okay. And at the time, he was also vice president of the United States.
Yes, he was. And so one of the reasons why he didn't want to show up was because he was the vice president. It would almost seem like he was committing treason mm-hmm. by going and actually speaking out and asking for a state to rise up, which is why he suppressed and told everybody, do not let anybody know that this letter is coming from me.
Okay.
Hold this in the strictest of confidence. And they were very good at keeping secrets, because nobody knew that the Kentucky resolutions came from Thomas Jefferson until almost after, you know, almost when he died.
Wow.
That was a secret, which is why he never openly responded, but he did respond in the Kentucky resolutions of 1799, and that was it. So yeah. He only made two comments, and he was really more afraid to, I'll just say, impugn or put a blemish on his character that mm-hmm. he was being manipulative in the government. I just didn't think he wanted to be remembered as a man that had such passion and love for liberty that he did what he did, because he felt he crossed the line.
So I want to share something with you really quick.
Sure, go
while
ahead.
We're on. Remember, you said that you don't know how long it'll take to ride by horseback. Uh-huh. So I looked it up, okay? It would take 7 days to walk from Monticello to Frankfort on today's roads.
Okay.
Which means, and 2 days on a bike. So somewhere about, it might take three or four or five days. To get from one to the other.
Right, so. Because it's not like he just, you know, the horse was riding by at the time. He had to probably make arrangements to say, as soon as it's ready, you know, I'll bring it to you, then you can get on your horse. I mean, it's not like it's a fax. I mean, I just, boom, and it's gone.
You're right.
They didn't have that technology. So right. the coordination that had to have happened, and so Jefferson... there's no doubt in my mind the reason this was done in October was, one, because of his duties as the president of the Senate and mm-hmm. all of the other duties. You know, he had his hands full, and to getting this done in secret so that nobody knew he did it is mm-hmm. why it took a few months.
Right.
So bottom line, if you go to the Avalon Project, it says that this was done in October 1798. Now, here's some disclosure, folks, because this is how the academic world has mislabeled this document, because it says on the Avalon Project that this is a draft of the Kentucky resolutions. The reason that they're doing this is because the final resolutions, or the second set of resolutions, become the final say on Kentucky's position. But it was, you know, it's they're two separate sets of resolutions. They basically called for this, and this actually went out and got promulgated. So, in other words, if it was a draft, it would never have been promulgated. Does that make sense?
I think so. Would they not have shared a draft?
No. A draft is something that is, you know, I'm working on. It's not ready for prime time. It's not ready for publication.
Okay.
If it goes to the recipients, you know, like I'm drafting an email, that means I haven't sent it yet.
Correct.
And so this is the disingenuous way the academia has really tried to present the facts with a slant to go, oh, well, this was just draft. Just disregard this.
So there were actually two sets of Kentucky resolutions.
Well, yes, absolutely two distinctive messages that Kentucky sent to the states, to their fellow, their sibling states, yes.
Okay,
so now, with that, now in October, the end of October, these things get to Thomas, or get to the Kentucky State House. Mm-hmm. So these were actually promulgated, or I should say, when you look at the document that I sent you, and if you look at the source of where these came from, I'm actually citing the...
You're citing the Avalon
Project. But actually, if you go to the website of the Kentucky website, you'll find that these things were sent out on the 10th of November. And it's a day I'll always remember because it's the Marine Corps birthday.
Okay.
And so it's kind of a, you know, a nice coincidence that Jefferson, or I should say the state of Kentucky, promulgated to all of the other states, you know, with their approval that they ratified, accepted these resolutions. They all agreed, and they sent these resolutions on November 10th.
So, quick question. When you say go to the Kentucky website, you mean the state of Kentucky?
Yeah, the state. I mean, if you search the Kentucky resolutions of 1798... With if you don't go to, because who runs the Avalon Project?
I don't know.
Yale.
I should know,
Yale University. Now, do you think Yale University is the bastion of conservative truth?
Absolutely not.
Not at all. I mean, so they want, they do what they can to actually put a little bit of a spin, or to, you know, and so it's a great repository. But just keep in mind that some of the things that they've taken latitude, because that was never a draft. When they sent this out from Kentucky, it was not a draft at all. It was actually a message that they sent, which is why Virginia responded in kind.
Okay.
Now, so now that we see that it took Jefferson this time from July to October, he sends this out. Well, what's Madison doing? Where's Madison employed?
Well, Madison,
he's not. He's actually not in Congress at the time. So Madison,
he's home in Virginia, right?
Yes. So guess what? Madison gets on his horse, and he knows that the Kentucky resolutions will be forthcoming. So he goes from Montpelier, or actually, yeah, I think it's Albemarle, but Montpelier, down to Richland, to the Virginia State House. And he, as soon as those resolutions land, he kind of comes in and says, let me show you what we need to do.
Okay.
And he literally goes in there and guides them on what they need to say in responding to this. And they give him that respect.
Wow.
And so, which is why we will read his report, because what ends up happening is after Kentucky sends out their resolutions, then Virginia responds in kind and agrees and calls for interposition. Many of the other states come back and create insinuations and actually, you know, assert that you guys are becoming treasonous. This is an insurrection. In other words, the other states that are, you know, have become so corrupted with big government ideals and wanting to actually get more money out of the federal government, because what just ended up happening in 1790, we talked about this before, you know, well in the summer or after the ratification debates, but before the Constitution, we talked about the Assumption Act.
Mm-hmm.
So how many states were loving the fact that this federal government was helping them out? Wow, you know, we didn't have to pay our debt. This is awesome.
Oops.
And what else can we get out of this government? How else can we aggrandize ourselves so that, you know, we can, you know, be richer for it?
And weaken our sovereignty at the same time.
There you go. So we already see the slow migration, and we see by the mid-1700s, late 1700s, in 1798, when the federal government started asserting a little tyranny. And these other states said, you know what, we're okay with this because we're a part of that party. We are Federalists, and we believe in big government. And we want to let the federal government have these powers. We're okay with it. And that right there, my friends, is the indictment that they were facing. Mm-hmm. Because the corruption is those in government, which is why is it that we're focused on First Amendment petitions at the county? Because that's government. The corruption trickles down. The trickle-down theory actually does work.
Mm-hmm.
And because it trickles down from the globalists and the corporations into government and down to the state and down to the counties.
Wow.
And they're getting we actually talked about this throughout many of the shows we've done, where I've showed you that, you know, when we looked at in the early days of the 1800s, and I actually kind of talked about this on the side, and I know I talk about this with people, how the corporations in America, you know, sure, they had manufacturing and DuPont and those types of corporations rising up in America, but we had old corporations that were existing that actually were creating franchises that nobody really knew. Because back in those days, they didn't have the term franchise. And it was plantations. It was the agrarian sector of the economy. Those were tantamount to corporations. A family would have this large plantation, and they would have what? They would have children. And those children would be given money to go buy lands in a neighboring state. And this was well underway by the time Missouri came along, which is why we've talked about how these people that were coming from these plantations, extending the franchise into Missouri, paid for this Missouri Compromise by basically bribing and throwing money at these legislators to allow this compromise to move forward. So folks, corporations and government have always, in America, have always found this attracting, you know, oh, they've got this energy, we've got this energy, it's like negative and positive, and boom, they attract.
Mm-hmm.
They've got the money, we've got the power, negative, positive, boom. And so we see how, whether it was the railroads, whether it was the farmers, when we start seeing how government started favoring some form of business, if it's agricultural business, if it is the railroad, you know, the raw, you know, acquiring of goods, and in Indiana, it was salt.
Mm-hmm.
So as we started looking at where the interests were, we could actually see the federal government starting to attune to and providing favors. And it got worse and worse, and they became more liberal at providing favors and creating alliances. And look at where we are today. This is why our government is controlled by those with money that, you know, are, you know, the tech sectors and so forth.
Yep.
So, okay, so the fact is, our government is really controlled by us, but we allow them to manipulate us. And they've become very good in learning how to manipulate us. It started with Christmas. Really, when you peel it all back and you start seeing it at the macro view, we're going into break right here. So we'll have to bring this back in, and then we'll get into the Virginia resolutions again. We're just going to review and not read them in their entirety. But the whole point is that, you know, there have been evil designs and trying to redirect the beauty of this beautiful republic that was designed by the divine hand of providence. We'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
You know, it's easy to support and to prove these assertions. It's really not that hard because there's plenty of people that have drilled into this stuff. You know, Trevor Lawdon, A. Ralph Epperson, there's been a lot of historians that have uncovered and kind of talked about and reported all of these different conspiracies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's as a matter of fact, in A. Ralph Epperson's talk about how communism really moved forward, when you look at it, why was America so chummy and gave such favors to communist Russia after World War II? Because we wanted to help them recover and we wanted them to grow strong so that we could compete against them and make a lot of money.
Hmm.
Having a Cold War allowed what industries to make a lot of money?
Military.
And then after when we thought the Cold War was really going on, they created a whole new set of industries that would actually become even more dominant than the military industry. Healthcare.
Hmm.
Education. Welfare. The nanny state. So when we look at the Hugh, Department of Hugh, that happened in the 50s, they already created the next level of controls. They started using the War Department and wars to kind of, this has all been manipulation. But when we really think about it, were they wrong in talking about the domino theory? They were really exposing the truth that communism is like a cancer and it will spread. And it does.
Right.
And so they use the domino theory to get us into Vietnam and to act, you know, from North Korea to Vietnam and fighting communism around the world. And it was the right thing to do. But the problem was that our country was subservient, or actually was basically became the sycophant to the British crown, who wanted communism to succeed.
Hang on a minute. You said that our government was subservient to who?
They became the sycophant.
Okay.
In other words, it's not that we didn't have superiority in many ways. We became the sycophant. We became the yes man for the British crown.
And the muscle.
Yes. All these nations, absolutely, as they became co-opted, as they became, I'll just say, perverted for this evil cause of a one-world government. Because the one-world government was formed, or the plan was formed in the 1700s.
Right. This isn't a new surprise.
Right. I mean, so when we look at how close we are to this and all the different relationships, and we see how banking and these world corporations, including big tech, you know, agriculture and so forth, they're all working together to move us into this next generation of slavery. It's slavery to the state, folks. That's what communism is. Instead of having a plantation owner where you actually get to know and they get to know you, you become just a number to the state. You want to see how, you know, harsh slavery can truly be when it becomes blind to who you are. See, on the plantations, you know, there's this personal relationship at least, right? And
right,
you could have a real evil, you know, slave owner, but if you had a good, like George Washington, who actually cared and he treated his slaves with such compassion. Even though it sounds like an oxymoron, even though it sounds like a paradox when a slave owner could treat their slaves with compassion.
Well, you know, it's there's even some biblical direction for treating your servants with compassion. But the other thing, you know, Harriet Tubman said something at one time. Let me rephrase that. I typically don't like to quote someone unless I can find the source. So Harriet Tubman is purported to have said this, and I believe if she didn't say this, she should have. I freed 1,000 slaves. I'd have freed 1,000 more if they only knew they were slaves. I think that's where we are.
There you go. Because there were a lot of people, and so. One of the things that I learned is when the slaves were freed, many of them actually didn't have this animosity towards those who they worked for. Why was that? Because they were treated humanely. Mm-hmm. Because they were kind of like a part of the family. And in many ways, like with George Washington, he tended to his slaves. When they were sick, he stayed with them. He didn't want to lose any of them to a sickness or anything, and it wasn't really about the money for him. I mean, this man, as I said, he would have no hesitation to shooting one of his soldiers in the back if they walked away from the line.
Right.
But when it came to a slave that ran away, he would go and not to capture them, to drag them back. He pleaded with them to come back with them because he knew that the slaves, if they got caught and became a slave to a tyrant, they wouldn't be treated the same way. He pleaded that they came back with him. He didn't go and force them to come back. It is interesting. And so, I mean, he was a very compassionate and a very humble man, and which is why he, you know, he relied on many people to do things that he felt he couldn't do as good. So why he had Madison write many things, you know, his correspondence and so forth, because he wanted them to be right. Anyway, we've really digressed. But the whole point here is that when Madison and Jefferson, you know, kind of coordinated this, it was kind of manipulative on their part, but they knew how they could actually get this started and moving to try to create a movement. These guys were geniuses. They were literally trying to create a movement, and they were successful.
Wait a minute. You just said they were successful when the state rebuffed them.
Yes, but in their efforts, they created a movement with whom? So now we look at the timeline. And now we're doing a little analysis up front when it's best to do this a little bit later. But what ends up happening in 1800? So we see that the Virginia resolutions go out what month?
December. Resolutions go out November. Right?
No. The Kentucky resolutions went out in November. The Virginia resolutions get released. It's at the very bottom of the Virginia resolutions. Go look at it.
Okay. I'll do that.
Okay. And
it's December. It's Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve. The very last week of December.
Okay.
So you see my point? So it took about 2 months from the Kentucky resolutions to the Virginia resolutions. So these, you know, these guys were schooled by Madison on why they were doing what they were doing.
Right.
So these go out now to the other states. Now it takes time to digest.
It takes time to travel.
Yes, it does. And so we're just looking at the timeline before we dive into the rest of these documents. So the Kentucky resolutions of 1799, when do those go out by Kentucky? Look at the very bottom of that document.
Okay, I got it open, so let me just get to it.
This is great, folks, because as we kind of lay this out, you're actually going to see how long it took and how patient these men were waiting for the states to come back and respond. It didn't happen just boom, 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 boom. You know, within a week or two, all of the states, you know, voted because they may not have been in session yet. So do you have the date yet when the final resolution comes from Kentucky and Thomas Jefferson?
Hang on just a minute. I will tell you.
Well, I don't want to. I'll just skip.
Okay. Here we go.
Go ahead.
It is December 3rd. It's almost a year, GR. It's December 3rd, 1799.
Okay, so you're proving my point. I'd rather you say it than me because I don't want to sound like I'm trying to make this all up. So the reality is it took him a year. Mm-hmm. To finally come to an acknowledgement. And it took Jefferson time, so it was probably maybe November or October when they finally said, okay, we got to lick our wounds. You know, we've gotten enough feedback, and, you know, it doesn't look good at all. All of the other states seem to be on board. So even though they sent these messages, and even though the messages were sent back with insinuations and insults, and Thomas Jefferson covers this. Even though that happened, they still succeeded because they created a movement, not amongst the states. They were trying to create their original effort was to create a movement. And they were focusing that movement on the state houses to get the state houses to move. But what they actually got was a movement with the people.
Ooh.
Which I proved this point because December 1799, what's next? What's the next month?
Well, the next month is, you know, like January, it's also a new century.
January of 1800, and it's also an election year where they now elect a new president.
Correct.
And so it's the beginning of a campaign season, isn't it?
Yes.
Ah, so and now we're seeing in the big picture the planets were really aligned for something to happen. This is where Jefferson turns to Madison and says, let's use this Republican Party that we created when we were up in Massachusetts. They were on the road, and it was in January sometime, when they came up with this idea of creating the Republican Party. And we're talking 1792.
Okay.
So they created this this Republican Party, but they never did anything with it. And then this is when Jefferson goes, let's use that and use a party to challenge the Federalists.
Okay.
Let me ask you, how successful were they in challenging the Federalists in 1800?
Well, Jefferson won the election.
Not only did he win the election, but they cleaned out many of the state houses. Many of the state houses were on the throes of being cleaned out. Now, when we look at this movement of the Republican Party, when Monroe was reelected as the Republican president, how many Electoral College votes went to another party?
If I remember correctly, it was one, right?
No.
Okay, hang on a minute.
There was one vote that wasn't cast.
Oh, there were no votes that went to another party.
That's right. All votes went to Monroe. So now I ask you, how successful was this revolution of the Republican Party?
The word sweep wouldn't give it justice.
Even though it wasn't an immediate sweep, though it took time, just like Martin Luther's movement, took 10 years. That's pretty much where we were it only took a year to actually change the hearts and minds of enough people to change the direction of this nation.
In 1 year. Don't tell me that we can't get Republic Review moving when we're being faced with this level of tyranny. All we need to do, the only problem is we don't have Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. But what we do have is we have the Lord and the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody out there that says, oh, you can't do it, they have no faith in the Lord.
Okay.
Because look at what these men did.
Wow.
And even though they may have had the credentials, you have to, it's just like the revolution, just like everything that they did. Every time they stepped up and stood up for liberty, the Lord blessed them. Why would we think that he wouldn't bless us?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so what we want to do is now we want to go into the Virginia resolutions of 1798. And so we just want to go through the highlights. There's just a few highlights. So in the very second resolution, this is what he says. He talks about that this assembly solemnly declares a warm attachment to the Union. And then he says this. Go ahead.
Let's see. To the, a warm attachment to the Union of the States, to maintain which it pledges all its powers, and that for this end it is their duty to watch over and oppose every infraction of those principles which constitute the only basis of that Union.
Okay, so in other words, it's not only that they're warmly attached, they have an obligation to defend, to oppose infractions of those principles that constitute the basis of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the third, the whole third resolution, this is what he says. And he repeats these words and he defends these words later on in both the report as well as in his notes on nullification. And we'll get to that, but go ahead.
Okay. So this is number three, that this assembly doth explicitly and peremptorily declare that it views the powers of the federal government as resulting from the compact to which the states are parties as limited by the plain sense and intention of the instrument constituting the compact, as no further valid that they are authorized by the grants enumerated in that compact, and that in case of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous exercise of other powers not granted by the said compact, the states who are parties thereto have the right and are in duty bound to interpose for arresting the progress of the evil and for maintaining within their respective limits the authorities, rights, and liberties appertaining to them. Wow.
Okay, so what really needs to be emphasized, because this is the action that in case of deliberate, blatant, palpable means blatant, and dangerous exercise of other powers not granted by the said compact, the states who are parties thereto have the right and are duty bound to interpose for arresting, to, in other words, to assert the necessary force for arresting the progress of the evil. In other words, for those powers being exercised, you need to exert the necessary force in arresting these unconstitutional powers.
Mm-hmm.
Is he mincing words here?
No.
Okay.
Not in the least.
Does it seem like he's saying, okay, each state needs to just nullify these, you know, and we'll just ignore them?
That is not what he's saying.
That's not at all what he's saying. How is it that anybody walked away and said, hey, you know, let's do what those guys did and just ignore the laws and nullify them? How is that happening? How is it that the John Birchers, 10th Amendment Center, Tom, I mean, these brilliant men, how is it that they're walking away and reading this and saying, oh, well, they're calling for single state nullification?
Are they reading this, is my question, because this is really clear. There's nothing ambiguous about this particular resolution.
Okay, so hold on here. There's one little part that we haven't read yet.
Okay.
Let's go down. Actually, there's two parts that are highlighted. So let's go to Resolution 6, and you tell me what it says right there.
Okay. that this state, having by its convention, which ratified the federal constitution, expressly declared that among other essential rights, quote, the liberty of conscience and of the press cannot be canceled, abridged, restrained, or modified by any authority of the United States, end quote.
Now, he's basically saying that the federal government cannot at all exercise these types of powers. That when we ratified this Constitution, it was clear, and he cited by citation, by quote, how they correct defined it. Okay, now read the very final part, the highlight that we want to read, because we've already read these things, but read the final highlight that we need to review.
Okay, this is in number 7.
There you go.
The General Assembly doth solemnly appeal to the like dispositions of the other states.
Okay, hold on real quick. What does he mean by the General Assembly?
So he's probably speaking of the legislature of Virginia.
Yes, absolutely. He is speaking very specifically. That is a term for the state legislature, the General Assembly. And because it's a bicameral, it means both the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So, doth solemnly appeal to the like dispositions of the other states, I guess that means the other General Assemblies, in confidence that they will concur with this Commonwealth in declaring, as it does hereby declare, that the acts aforesaid are unconstitutional, and that the necessary and proper measures will be taken by each for cooperating with this state in maintaining the authorities, rights, and liberties referred to the states respectively or to the people.
Okay, so one thing that really has to be emphasized here, folks, is this little line here that says, and that the necessary and proper measures will be taken by each state for cooperating with this state in maintaining the authorities, these are capitalized, folks, authorities, rights, and liberties referred to the states respectively or to the people. So he's really helping to clarify that interposition, that there is no bars to be held, that all the necessary and proper measures will be taken by each state, not just their state, you know, we'll do it. No, each state. He was very clear. Not one state to nullify. Each state needed to do this, or at least, and he comes to this knowledge that a majority of the states must do this. Because
correct,
he talks about the plurality. You can't just have one state, and this comes out of the notes of nullification, that it doesn't require unanimity like the Articles of Confederation, you know, where everybody has to do it. You need at least a majority of the states, not three-fourths, because we're talking about enforcing the compact. We're talking about getting a tribunal to judge. You just need a majority of the panel to judge and say, this is a violation, stop, cease, and desist. Just like we see the Supreme Court with a 5-4 decision that actually supports New Jersey's tyranny in firing nurses who refuse to take the vaccination.
Right.
The Supreme Court, that just happened yesterday. The Supreme
Court. Yes. I heard that.
Okay. And so most people are saying, well, we can trust the Supreme Court now because we got Trump appointees there.
Wrong.
Right.
So here's another one. I saw a headline. Let me share this if you don't mind. I saw a headline that got my attention, and I may write something on it.
Okay.
It says 26 attorneys general. This is from this is from the Center Square. It was published this week. 26 attorneys general, this is what they're saying, give states the authority to enforce federal immigration law. This is wrong on so many levels, okay? Because that now, so these attorneys general are getting together, and the issue is the invasion. But
right,
that's not what they're saying.
Right.
Okay? They're saying, hey, give us the authority to enforce immigration law. Dude, attorneys, lawyers, read the Constitution. You have the authority to protect your states from invasion.
Right.
And call upon the federal government to do its job.
So what is what Paul is saying, folks, is they already possess the authority, but not the attorney generals, not the court and the money-making machine, the militia, the governor. The states already have the power and authority to call forth their militia and to execute the laws of the union. They don't need to be federalized to do it within their state.
Correct.
Every state that actually looks at this invasion as repugnant and must repel every single one of them, would be it would behoove of them to call forth the militia and to basically stop any invaders from getting into their country and gathering all invaders and repelling them per the Constitution. That's what they're really supposed to be doing.
Right.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, but you're right. Absolutely. And so many different, literally at least two, they're trying to say, well, give us the power when the state already possesses the power, and it shouldn't be them. They're not the ones that need to be enforcing.
It's like someone breaks into your home and they're saying, hey, give me the power to use my gun to protect my family. No, that's it.
And actually, these guys don't want to use guns. They want to actually drag these people into court to prosecute. That's how they want to enforce. They don't care about actually repelling. They're looking at, you know, using the court. Because what does an attorney do? Well, we got to charge these people. Then we'll put them into court, and then we'll get rid of them.
Jerry, I don't know if you saw the I don't know if you saw the there were some candidates for federal judgeships. And Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana was questioning these folks. Okay, now these were looking for opportunities on the federal bench, right? And so Senator Kennedy asked one of them, what is Article 2 of the Constitution? Okay, and she gives this flowery answer. Well, you know, I've never run into that in my deliberations, okay? And so he asked someone else, what's Article 2 of the Constitution? Let me tell you what I really observed from that. If a common citizen has read the Constitution once, they know more than 99% of Americans. And if they've read it twice, they might know more than a federal judge.
And I know it comes across arrogant, folks, when I am literally, and we got less than a minute, when I literally make a statement that I can drive constitutional lawyers out of the room because they don't and they cannot cite founding documents and hardcore terms and definitions of the compact. It's that bad.
They don't get it in school, GR.
It's like reading the scriptures. I tell people, how many preachers don't even read the scriptures, but when the people actually do, they understand and can see how the preachers may be misleading them. The truth is right here. They're speaking to us from the dust, as I've said before. Now, with that, thank you very much for joining us, Paul, and we'll have you back to do, for tomorrow, even more. We'll get into the Kentucky Resolution 1799 and so forth. Folks, I think this was a great show. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities,
responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.